and welcome to Life Matters. Natasha Mitchell joining you now on ABC RN, where we're channeling the late great, well, Catherine the Great this morning. Now, why would I think you might be intrigued by one of Russia's longest ruling leaders over two centuries after her death? Well, according to all reports, her reign sounds like it was extraordinary. She led an era of massive reform from education to the arts, economically, socially. Some have called it the Russian Enlightenment. Catherine herself once said, "A capable ruler must be guided by circumstances, conjecture and conjunctions." Well, in a moment, RN's Amanda Smith is transporting you to the National Gallery of Victoria to meet four 21st century Catherines.
I saw women's leadership everywhere. All the important things were being done by women. The hospital, the telephone exchange, Mrs. O'Kane at the railway hotel. She was very powerful.
I had a great history teacher who actually taught me about Catherine the Great, called Mrs. Richards, who was probably the first person who used to badger me about taking things seriously and realising my potential.
Being an outsider, I could start again. So I didn't carry the baggage of what I'd grown up, and people who knew me to be this shy little girl who was too scared to speak. Suddenly I was in a new environment. Actually, I could be somebody else.
My first job was actually at Vogue. And I do remember being in the art department, sort of looking at the wall. If any of you have seen The Devil Wears Prada, we have these walls where the magazine's all up, and thinking, that should be there and I do this way. I think I could do this.
So that was true, that film, was it?
Yes, a little bit of it's true.
Well, now, before I tell you who the stars of the show are today, this week is Mental As across the ABC, you might have noticed. This is where we acknowledge and celebrate Mental Health Week with you and, let it be said, raise funds too for mental health research. And I'm very pleased to be a Mental As ambassador again this year. And on Life Matters, here's what we want your help with all this week. And we kicked off on Friday with a talk back to get us started. We're collecting your little acts of kindness. We got some extraordinary calls on Friday, really beautiful stories of little acts, little gestures, words or comments that made a difference to you, that someone delivered to you at a time in your life when you were having a really tough time. And they can just be little. They might be cakes or hugs or the right words at the right time. It might be something a stranger did for you out of the blue, something a colleague said. And here's the thing, I've also invited RN presenters to share their own little acts of kindness from their own life this week, and they are just gems. And we're going to start now with Anne Jones, who is, of course, presenter of Off Track. Here's Anne.
Hello, Anne Jones here, host of Off Track, and I've been a lucky woman over time. So many acts of kindness have been thrown in my direction, but the one I wanted to share today is from actually when I was little. My mum became deathly ill very quickly and was taken to the city into a hospital for what seemed like forever for me as a little girl. We were living alone together at that stage, so you can imagine how worried I was. My mum's best friends just took me in. Simple as that. Another Strasbourg sandwich to make for lunch and just pulling the sleeping bag out at night, or a trip to the Plaster Funhouse. But that dose of normality, of family, was just what a little girl needed. So this is for you, Mrs. Joy and Mrs. Shearer. I still owe you for the little acts of kindness then and over all the years since. I might have grown up, but I haven't forgotten.
Isn't that beautiful? Thank you, Anne Jones. And yes, this is a week of little acts of kindness. So we want to hear from you, and this is how you can get them to us. Stories from your own life of little acts that someone did for you at a time when you were doing it tough or rough. Leave it on our listener line, 02 833 1430. Just leave a little story, 02 833 1430. You can post your little act of kindness on our website or indeed on our Facebook page or on Twitter. And be sure to use the hashtag if you're posting it on social media, #ABCLittleActs. And #MentalAs. And we're going to collate them, and deliver you a compendium of little acts, which you can share with others. And do check out the Life Matters website as well. Lots of information there and some, well, sources of inspiration as well. And so to women in leadership, and to Catherine the Great, who, as it happens, amassed one of the world's largest art collections, some of which is on display at the National Gallery of Victoria at the moment, which is where Catherine the Leader and Catherine the Art Lover came together at a forum hosted recently by RN's Amanda Smith. Joining Amanda, the Honourable Dame Quinton Brice, Australia's first and only female Governor-General, a community and human rights advocate, lawyer, academic, former Governor of Queensland, Ruth Picker, who is a partner at Ernst & Young, where she heads up Asia-Pacific Risk Management, and she's a member of EY's Global Risk Management Executive. We've got Edwina McCann, who is the editor of Australian Vogue and chair of the Australian Fashion Council, and Professor Helen Sullivan, Foundation Director of the Melbourne School of Government at the Uni of Melbourne and a Fellow of the Institute of Public Administration Australia. So let's take it away with Amanda Smith.
Now, this event has been prompted by the Masterpieces from the Hermitage exhibition here at the National Gallery of Victoria, works, as you know, from the collection of Catherine the Great. Catherine was probably great in lots of ways, and you have to say that she certainly had leadership qualities. And so she's really inspired this evening's conversation around women and leadership in the here and now. So given that Catherine the Great is the inspiration for this, I'm going to use her life to guide us through this discussion. For a start, she wasn't born to rule. She was an outsider brought to the Russian court. She turned herself into a leader. In her case, by marrying well and then deposing her husband and assuming power as the Empress of Russia. I don't know if any of your experiences parallel that. I'm imagining not. But the question I do want to put to each of you, first of all, is when and how did you know you had the potential to be a leader? There must have been a point at which Catherine thought, I can do this. Was there that point for you, Quentin?
Look, I have to say first, I can't believe I'm sitting here with you with your familiar voice. Everything I know is from Radio National.
Me too. Thank you.
Look, I've been thinking a lot about leadership, and I've been remembering way back in the 40s when I was a little girl in a bush town in remote Western Queensland, I saw women's leadership around me everywhere. All the important things were being done by women. The hospital, the telephone exchange, Mrs. O'Kane at the railway hotel. She was very powerful. and I just think of growing up with that women's leadership. It was part of my early childhood, women in leadership roles, in running important things like the Red Cross and the organisations that really made a difference to the West and isolation. But I suppose, when did I start thinking about leadership? Probably at school, I think, boarding school. Our headmistress was probably, for most of my generation, I think, the first woman we saw in a leadership role, and she was somebody for whom we had enormous respect but a deep affection. Very influential. She had children. She drove a car, which a lot of women didn't do in those days. She, you know, you could see this enormous capacity in a wonderful, influential woman. And I suppose it was then, really, that... But I've been asking myself, was that just about seniority? You know, getting to be the prefect and the captain of this and that, in a very small pond.
Helen, how about for you?
Well, I'm still not sure if I would consider myself to be a leader.
For the purposes of this evening, you are a leader.
Okay. I had a great history teacher who actually taught me about Catherine the Great, called Mrs. Richards, who was probably the first person who used to badger me about taking things seriously and doing proper work and realising my potential. And I think after that, I've had a number of jobs in universities where I've been identified as the person who would step up to do whatever it was next. And I always used to, at that moment, decide I was going to leave that job and go somewhere else. And eventually I got to the point where I actually came halfway around the world to Australia to avoid one of those situations. And then 6 months later, after I'd arrived in Australia, they asked me to set up the School of Government. And I realised at that point that it was partly fear that I'd been afraid of leadership, but also, actually, none of the leadership positions I'd been offered in the previous 10 years were the right ones for me, and that this one was the right one, and it was in the right place at the right time for me. And so while it does seem like an awfully long, you know, extraordinary thing to do, to travel halfway around the world to run away from something, I think you do end up where you should be eventually.
Mm. Edwina? Probably the same thing. My first experience of being a leader was being a prefect at school. And then my first job was actually at Vogue. This is the second time I've worked at Vogue. And I do remember being in the art department, sort of looking at the wall. If any of you have seen The Devil Wears Prada, we have these walls where the magazine's all up, and thinking, oh, I think that should be there and that should be there, and I do this way. And I remember thinking at that time, I think I could do this. So, yeah, that was probably my first desire, anyway.
So that was true, that film, was it?
Yes, a little bit of it's true. I'm not as mean to my assistants as I thought.
We might talk about that later. Ruth, what about for you?
Well, first of all, could I say I can't believe I'm sitting next to Quentin Price. I think for me, what resonated with what you said, Amanda, about Catherine the Great was being an outsider. So we came to Australia and I was an outsider and I had to find a way to fit in. And in fact, one of the first things I was forced to do was to go up on stage and give a speech. And I had to very quickly acquire an Australian accent. I had an audience probably double the size of this one, and I had to talk about accounting standards, and my boss had said to me, I can't give this lecture, can you give it? And I said, no, I don't think so. And he said, yeah, sure you can. And I was just thrown into it, and I had to. So I think part of what I learned from that was I could acquire a new personality. Being an outsider, I could start again. So I didn't carry the baggage of what I'd grown up, and people who knew me to be the shy little girl who was too scared to speak. Suddenly I was in a new environment. Actually, I could be somebody else. And it was probably from then that I lost the shyness.
Women are often outsiders, or feel like outsiders.
Do you?
We have been excluded from a lot of things. It's certainly a sense that I've had. Yes, quite often in my life, actually.
Well, now, Catherine the Great, once she established her authority, of course, had to survive threats to it. For example, I think there were 26 rival claimants to the throne during her time, and about 16 of those were men who claimed to be her husband, Peter III. Helen, we know about the glass ceiling, but
I don't have any husbands.
I'm going to ask you about that. We're leaping off that into the glass precipice. In other words, the position of threat you face once you're in a position of power. Can you talk about the glass precipice? It's a term I've only recently heard of.
I only came across it when you suggested it as a term, and it's made me think. There's a, for any of you who are familiar with universities and academia, you'll know there's a phrase that's attributed to lots of different people, but I think sums up a version of academia quite well, which is that academic politics are so vicious because the stakes are so small. And I think that there is a this notion of the glass precipice. I mean, I think whether, you know, it doesn't really matter what gender you are in universities, there are, because universities are full of brilliant people who often just want to be left alone. And if they aren't left alone, can cause an awful lot of trouble for an awful lot of people. So the threats and the disruptions, if you like, are more about, for me at least, how you create an environment in which those people who are not the slightest bit interested in university politics or how things work or how A gets to B, they just want to do their research or they just want to teach their students. Part of my job is dealing with all the other stuff, is dealing with all of the university politics. So for me, it's that kind of disruption. I can't imagine that... I am going to say, I can't imagine that there's anybody else who'd want my job, because my job is actually really, really hard. But I love it. And so even if somebody else did want it, they wouldn't get it.
Quentin, one of the things about this term, the glass precipice, is the idea that women are often given a position of power when an organisation is ailing. It's the sort of classic Joan Kerner scenario, really. And so, in a sense, they're set up to fail. Now, I don't think that's probably been a scenario in your life, but I wonder if you'd care to comment on that.
Well, I think we have observed that, and Joan, who was just a truly wonderful woman, I think that she's been used, her name's been used in that context often, and another couple of other state premiers too, and I think that's something I've observed, that point that you're making. It happens. I remember once missing out on a job, actually, that I was very disappointed about. One of those jobs that you think, that's got my name on it. That's just meant for me, you know, and you go and invest in it all and miss out on it and feel disappointed and outraged and all those feelings. And then later on you realise, thank heavens I missed out on that. And there's one very much in my mind where I think that it wasn't about the person, but it was a job set up that in itself was almost set up to fail, I think.
And well, lucky yeah. you then.
Yes, indeed. There's a lot of luck in everything, really.
One of the first things that you see when you go to the Hermitage exhibition is that enormous portrait of Catherine, which to me looks like a woman who is seriously power-dressed. You know, she's got her imperial crown and sceptre and ermine cape on and so forth. She, however, thought that the portrait made her look very ordinary. That she said that she'd been depicted like a Swedish cook, coarse and simple. Now, I don't know why a Swedish cook in particular she names. But Edwina, I wonder if you could comment. It strikes me from that comment and leaping into our own age and time, are women always too harsh on their looks?
Oh, in my experience, definitely. We shoot a lot of portraits, and the level of concern in terms of how they look and how uncomfortable they are in front of the camera constantly surprises me, especially when they look so exceptional most of the time. And obviously, you know, we're bringing them the best of Vogue, we're dressing them particularly well, and they've got wonderful hair and makeup and the very best photographers, so we're not going to let anything go wrong. And yet, yes, I think women are highly critical of the way they look.
Well, Ruth, what you wear in the workplace is not incidental. It's not an incidental matter in the workplace. Power dressing for men is comfortable, not very restrictive.
Boring.
Maybe boring. Is it possible for women to dress with a kind of style and comfort and be taken seriously in the workplace, in your workplace?
It's an interesting question. When I first started, which was 32 years ago, women were expected to look like men. And we wore these suits, and on me I looked totally ridiculous because the shoulder pads were out there and the arms were too long, and I never cut it trying to look like a man. So eventually I decided I would just be myself, thanks to some wonderful mentoring by some wonderful females and men actually in our organisation as well. And they said, just be yourself. Just dress how you're comfortable, be yourself. So I don't wear jackets anymore because I look stupid in a jacket. And I wear a dress and a cardigan just like this to the office. And it's interesting that my team, the feedback I've got from female staff, younger staff, have said to me, the way you look makes you more accessible, makes you more approachable. You look just like a normal person. You don't look like you're putting a mask on for work. So I feel comfortable in my skin, and I think it makes them feel comfortable as well.
Quentin, you're a famous, excellent dresser. How have you used clothes to establish yourself in positions you've held?
Well, I love clothes. I had one of those mothers who smocked four daughters' beautiful little Liberty print dresses, so, you know, I blame her, really. And I'm a very big supporter of the fashion industry, Edwina will tell you. But I think we don't have that era of, we've passed that era of power dressing. I must say women lawyers really got into it, didn't they? You know, with the suits. And I did have a period actually where I wore a shirt and a tie. But, you know, dressing is, it's an issue, a professional issue. Though I think comfort you know, can be a bit of a challenge with some of our things, I have to confess. And I see why a lot of women almost have a uniform of a trouser suit, and that's because that is comfortable, I think.
Well, you see it in someone like Penny Wong. You know, she really does that to a T, doesn't she? That pantsuit, the equivalent really of a male style in politics. Yeah.
Well, I've gone through every era, you know. I've worn every fashion about five times, I think. Back they come again.
I hope you've kept it all just for when
it comes
back.
I've kept quite a bit of it, yes. And my daughters ring up and say, "Mum, remember that yellow and green Mary Meko striped dress you had?" And I'm going, "What? Can you find it for me?"
The Honourable Dame Quinton Bryce, former Governor-General, talking, well, fashion with Ruth Picker. A partner at Ernst & Young, Helen Sullivan, the Director of the Melbourne School of Government, and Edwina McCann, the Editor of Vogue Australia. Amanda Smith is our host today here on Life Matters on ABC RN. We're talking women in leadership at the National Gallery of Victoria on the occasion of an exhibition of works there drawn from Catherine the Great's collection, the 18th century Russian empress and great reformer who reigned for over 30 years.
Okay, now one of the things that Catherine loved to do was ride horses, and she rode a horse not side saddle as ladies were supposed to, but astride like men. She was accused of being masculine doing that sort of stuff. Edwina, have you ever felt you've had to man up in the workplace?
I worked for quite a while at the Australian newspaper at a time when most of the editors around various newspapers at the moment were all in the one newsroom. And I would describe that as quite an aggressive place to work on occasions. However, I found that having your own style was much more disarming and effective than actually trying to compete with men in their style. So if you could retain your, you know, your voice, you were actually able to have more control of the situation.
Ruth, do you think there's such a thing as female leadership?
A female leadership style. This is the cue for my story. So the story I wanted to tell, it's called The Story of Thomas and the Agenda. And I'll set the scene.
I like it already.
I'll set the scene for the story. It was when I was working in London a few years ago, and I was asked to build and lead a new team, actually being given a dysfunctional team. So interesting, the point that you made before, being told, here's a mess, fix it. So this was a team based in London, but it was global. And we recruited people into the team from countries all over the world, and they stayed in the team for a few years, and then they went back home to their EY office, wherever they had come from. So Thomas was a new member to the team, and he joined us from Germany. And we're in an open plan office, and I'm sitting at my desk. We don't have offices, so we just have a desk. And I'm sitting here, and my assistant, Annabelle, was sitting pretty much there next to me. And Thomas comes up to Annabelle, and he says to Annabelle, "I see I have an appointment in my diary on Monday for some strange thing called a coffee catch-up with Ruth." Now, I'm sitting here, and Thomas is speaking to Annabelle, who's sitting there. And he said to her, "What is a coffee catch-up? And is there an agenda for it?" And I said, "Hi, Thomas. It's Ruth. I'm here. You can speak to me. All we're going to do is we're going to have a cup of coffee, and we're just going to have a chat about how you're doing." He'd been in the team a few weeks. They were by then a high-performing team, and I knew they would be looking after him, but I just wanted to check in with him as I did with everyone in the team every month or so. So this was our first coffee catch-up. And I said, "Don't worry about it, please. There's no agenda," because I didn't want him going home that weekend and fretting about the coffee catch-up. So I said, "Don't worry, we're just going to have a chat." And on the Monday, we went to the coffee shop next door. You can see I'd been in Melbourne a long time because I had to have my coffee. And we chatted, and I asked him how he was doing and how his family was and how he was fitting into the team. And I spoke a bit about my family, so transparency, making some disclosures about myself. And at the end of it, I said, "So was that so bad, Thomas?" He said, "No, that was really unusual." He said, but yeah, I like this coffee catch-up thing." And I said, "Okay, so if we do that every month, are you okay with that?" And he said, "Yeah, I like that." So I think that the moral of that story is, that is what I would call a female leadership style, and I summarise it with the acronym CALM. I'm in risk management. I have to be extremely calm, C-A-L-M, when everybody else is freaking out around me. I have to be calmer than all of them, so C-A-L-M-E-R, and they stand for my definition of leadership, which is care, being authentic, listening, two ears, one mouth, use them in that proportion. M, motivate people quietly. My style is to motivate people one-on-one, not standing up and calling people to war. Motivate and mentor. Empower the individual and empower the team and let them run themselves. And finally, respect. The R is for respect. Respect everybody. Treat everybody with respect. And that's what I define as a female leadership style.
I think there are some times when you do have to man up and remember the steel that we all have inside us, and it is when you are being shouted at, treated in rude, aggressive ways, and you have to call on that capacity.
How do you
capacity.
Man up, Quentin?
I guess it's about, you know, body language and how you speak and how you look.
I've had an extraordinary experience recently of being encouraged to man down. I had cause to talk to somebody outside our organisation about various things, and in the course of the conversation, this issue of leadership came up, and I asked about his impressions of my style of leadership, and he sat there and looked very uncomfortable and said, well, you're perceived as a very strong leader, but how can I put this? As my father used to say, you catch more flies with honey than you do with vinegar. And I thought about this for a while, and I said, would you have said that to me if I was a man? And he got very, didn't really want to talk about that after that. But there was something in there, because I see myself, and I hope, well, there are people here who can tell you otherwise, I hope that I am a collaborative leader. But there are times when you do have to be strong and decisive.
Do we equate a female leadership style with being collaborative? Is that what it is?
Yeah. I think it's a quality of women's leadership, and I think it's very effective, and it's something to be very proud of that we are good at.
That's a style that suits me, and I'm happy with it, but it's not the only style that I have, and I shouldn't imagine it's the only style that any of us have. But it's interesting how other people perceive what they see as an appropriate way of behaving.
Edwina, did you want to add to that?
I was just going to say, I think that's absolutely right. There has to be a decision still. And I often say it to young girls, you know, who are working for me, and especially when you're making decisions about creative subjects, for example, there's no right decision or wrong decision. There's just a decision. And you have to make it, and then...
And you have to have the courage to make
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Mm. And I think leadership works best when you can be very decisive, where you listen and you take in everyone's opinion, but you're willing to make a decision.
Mm. Now, Catherine the Great had a pretty wild personal life. She married a man of entitlement, but he was a complete dud of a human being. And she had lots and lots of lovers. Now, I'm not going to ask you about your love life, but I am going to ask you about work-life balance. For example, Quentin, is it possible to work part-time, at least for some of your career, and still get ahead?
It can be risky, I think, if I'm being absolutely honest about that. I think we still have a long way to go before we recognise the value and the contribution and reward it as such of part-time and job sharing and flexibility. We talk about work-life balance. We talk and talk and talk about it. But we've got a very long way to go. And it's an enormously important issue for our country, for men and women. It's very tough for women whom I watch, some of whom I mentor quietly in the background, support and encourage. It's something I feel very deeply about as an elder, that sort of role of encouraging the development in women's leadership, personal support in particular that I observe women needing, that they seek out from me sometimes. And I see enormous pressures on a lot of women in work and family. The thing that I want to pass on particularly to women is how important it is to take good care of themselves. That's what the lesson I have learned that I feel very strongly about. And for girls growing up, I think to develop the capacity for quietness and stillness and going inside oneself, leaving time for beauty, like this exhibition, for music and literature and poetry, remembering, you know, that the most important journey in life is to the centre of oneself. These are the issues that I feel deeply about at this stage in my life, in the context of work and family and balance and living a richly rewarding, fulfilling life.
Are there times when you haven't looked after yourself, haven't attended to those
certainly,
things?
I've, you know, when I remind my children occasionally when they're, you know, facing some of these challenges, I have 11 grandchildren, I like that to be mentioned. And, you know, when I say, you know, how I had 5 children under 7, they go, what were you thinking, Mum? You know. Yes, I've learned a lot of these lessons the hard way, and how vulnerable your health can be as a mother, and the way we expect mothers now to, you know, have a baby, back at work. The first question people ask you is, when are you going back to work? And, you know, I think we have to remember that, you know, one of the great reforms was maternity leave, and the basis of the argument in that case, from my perspective, and I was engaged in it, was protecting the unique childbearing and child-rearing role of women. So it's a really serious issue for the development of women's leadership and potential and opportunities that are very important on our agenda. We've got a long way to go.
Well, Ruth, tell us about how it pertains in your industry, which is, I imagine, still pretty heavily male-dominated. I mean, could you work part-time and get ahead?
Yeah, you can now. You couldn't 32 years ago, but you can now. But I think it depends on the stage of your career, and it depends on, when I look at it from a global perspective, it does also depend on the labour market that you're in. So, for example, childcare is much cheaper for my Asian colleagues than it is for my Australian colleagues, and that is a big factor. It's a lot easier for them to get childcare, and it's quite standard to have a nanny at home, whereas it's much more difficult in Australia, for example, and I think that does play a part. But our organisation has had a diversity and inclusiveness campaign running for at least 10 years, and I must say it's thanks to some very good men who, when a leadership position comes up, they always say, let's make sure that when we're choosing someone for a leader, there is at least one woman. And our current leader always says, if there isn't a woman on that list, he will say, why? Why isn't there one? So it's a very conscious decision to increase our female partner percentage. And the challenge we see is exactly around child rearing and having maternity leave.
Catherine was guided and influenced in her thinking by French philosophers, Voltaire and Diderot. Edwina, who do you take advice from? Who has influenced you in your values, priorities as a leader?
Recently, last year, we had Franca Sozzani out here as the editor of Italian Vogue, who's been in that chair for about 25 or 26 years. And she took me aside when we were in Bondi and we were looking over the beach and everything. And I said, oh, yes, I walk here in the morning. And she said, you walk here in the morning and then you go to work in your Vogue office. And I said, yes, most days. And she said, without doubt, you are the luckiest Vogue editor in the world. And whilst obviously, you know, that wasn't hugely influential in terms of, you know, my career path or anything, it did make me stop and realise just how lucky I was. In the industry I work in, of course, you know, there's a tendency to believe that New York is the centre of the universe, and clearly, you know, Paris is the centre of ready-to-wear and couture, but that what I had in Australia and the balance, really, of great lifestyle and this incredible, you know, inspiring job and a wonderful lifestyle for my two young children was quite extraordinary, and that I should be more grateful for it. And I think that optimism and being grateful is a really important part of being a leader as well. It's very easy to get bogged down in the things are too hard or it could be better if. And I think it's very important to remember what, you know, what you've got.
Geographic work-life balance. Let me put that question, though, Helen, to you about who you get advice, guidance, who has influenced your priorities or your values?
In terms of who I take advice from in my career, I have a very small group of friends that I've had for a very long time who aren't academics, who have what they call proper jobs. And they're people who, men and women, who can be relied upon to tell me absolutely what they think without fear or favour. And I'm also extraordinarily lucky that in my current job at the University of Melbourne, there are now a sizable number of women in very, very senior positions, some of whom are here this evening, who just are always available to offer advice. Sometimes you don't want to take it, but whether or not you take it, for me, certainly, the fact that I work in an organisation where there are women at very senior levels and lots of them does just enable you to think about yourself and to think about your possibilities in a very different way than you might do otherwise.
Quentin, you mentioned that you mentor others now, but who has guided or influenced you most professionally?
I've worked with some wonderful colleagues. Whenever I'm in Melbourne, I think of Dame Beryl Beaurepaire, who was the convener of the National Women's Advisory Council. And I was about 34 when I was appointed to that council. It was a very controversial, path-breaking first. And I'll always remember the advice she used to give us. She'd say, go straight to the top, you know. And we'd hear her saying, get me Malcolm, you know. And I tell you what, that advice, geez, it's got me into trouble sometimes. Ooh. You mean you went to talk to a widow? But really, wherever I've worked, marvellous colleagues working together, and I think that really probably reflects a career in human rights over a long period of time. And yeah, so many inspiring people, and it's really by their example, I think. And very many of them, I have to say, leaders in the Australian women's movement, really.
Former Governor-General, the Honourable Dame Quinton Bryce, on Life Matters, coming from a forum at the National Gallery of Victoria on women and leadership to coincide with an exhibition of art drawn from the collection of that great leader in history, Catherine the Great. And also with our guest host today, RN's Amanda Smith, is Helen Sullivan, Foundation Director of the School of Government at Melbourne University, Ruth Picker, who heads up Ernst & Young's Risk Management in the Asia Pacific, and the editor of Vogue Australia, Edwina McCann.
Something that struck me about how Catherine the Great regarded herself, Catherine the Great wrote her own epitaph. And one thing that she said was that when she was a teenager, she was brought to the Russian court and she was so lonely and so bored that she read everything. This is what she wrote. 18 years of loneliness and boredom made her read many books. So in a sort of situation of confinement, I suppose, she educated herself, broadened her mind. And I wonder if it's true that women who succeed, and this is no doubt true of men as well, but we're talking about women tonight. Is it true that successful women, I think this relates to what you were saying, Edwina, so I'll get you to pick up on this first. Successful women are the ones who can take advantage of, who can find the positive in whatever situation they find themselves in.
Definitely. My saying, or, you know, my motto would be, this too will pass. You realise that everything will be okay. I've had many, many deputies who are always in a panic that the magazine won't go to print, or that, you know, this won't happen online, or the event won't happen, and it always does. So the sooner you can come to terms with that and remain calm in the face of stress for those around you, because that is incredibly important, the sooner you can start to bring, I think, more optimism to the job. And definitely being able to see the positives and the opportunities is without doubt, I think, in terms of my work, the most important quality you need, especially in an evolving media market, in a market that is in a permanent state of disruption. Mm. You're constantly looking for the new opportunities, the new revenue streams. You're reinventing work practices, and you really have to motivate people to come with you, a lot of young women in my case, to come with you. So they've got to believe in you.
And how do you do that? How do you make them believe in you?
I hope by leading by example. I don't expect anything of them that I wouldn't expect of myself. I hope by a sense of hard work but enjoying your work, and certainly a pride in what we do. And then I think perhaps, again, treating everybody the same, taking the time to stop and talk to the intern and taking the time to congratulate people. That's a big thing people forget. You've got to tell people when they do a good job. I think we think they know it, but people don't. And that congratulations, whether it's by email, if you're busy or interstate or something, or just turning around and saying, you know what, that piece was fantastic, will go a long, long way in terms of building loyalty for your leadership, and also, I think, in terms of productivity and people being willing to go that extra mile for you.
Mm. We'll get questions from you in just a moment, but Ruth, do you want to comment on
Absolutely, especially the last point about saying thank you. I had because my team at the moment are all over the world and work in different countries and time zones, I don't see them physically often, so we do a lot by email and over the phone. And one team member did a fantastic job a couple of weeks ago, and I sent her a little thank you note, and I said, thank you, I'm lucky to have you on my team. And she sent me a reply, which was a picture of a flower, and the flower said, you inspire me. And I thought, gee, that was really nice. And then I thought of my own boss, the person that I report to, and I thought, you know, he inspires me. So I sent him the flower. And I said, I received this from one of my team members, but it made me think that actually you inspire me, and I sent it to him. And he said, you know, hardly anybody ever says thank you to me, to him. So I think it's a virtuous circle.
Yes, and that's actually an interesting point, isn't it? Because while you as a person in a position of leadership might attend to thanking your staff, it's actually also about, well, it's the encouragement of them to feed back to you as well, I suppose, either positively or negatively. I mean, how do each of you respond to negative feedback from people you're working with? Quentin?
Well, I think that, and your previous question, that makes me think about, you know, getting through tough times, really. And, you're talking about Catherine and being bored and reading. Oh, what a lovely idea. but that really is about your inner resources. And, you know, that is what I want for my grandchildren, for them to develop. I think of it being in this place, I suppose, an appreciation and a love and an engagement in the lovely things in life, in beauty, in art and poetry, and building up those inner resources that we all need, because there are tough gullies we all go through when you want to have to be able to draw on them. I go on about it a bit, but I'm just feeling very deeply about that. It must be a sign of being an elder, I think.
Let's open this conversation up to you now. While you're thinking about that, I'll give you my top three tips for women. You can add yours. I think mine are, first of all, speak in your own voice, not in a girly voice. Mm-hmm. Amazing how many women do that. Don't say sorry all the time. Unless you've done something wrong, then apologise. But otherwise, stop saying sorry. And, well, I've got four actually, not three, I've realised. Number three is try not to take it all so personally. And number four is develop a firm handshake. We have a question down here.
Thank you so much, ladies. This evening has been absolutely fantastic. And I wanted to thank Dame Quentin in particular for talking about inner resources and how important that is. As a young professional, I've learned far too early how important health is when working in a stressful environment. And I'm currently rereading my favourite book, which is Arianna Huffington's thrive. I call it Lean In 2.0. And Ariana speaks about currently we have two metrics that make up success or a successful career and successful life, which are money and power. And Dame Quinton, you touched on sort of the other things in life that are important, as does Ariana. And she sort of explores the idea that there needs to be a third metric, which is basically made up of four pillars, which are well-being, wisdom, wonder, and giving. And so I was hoping if the panel could just sort of delve a little bit deeper into sort of a more well-rounded perspective on women in leadership across sort of all aspects of your lives. Thanks.
I met Ariana when she was out here, and it's fascinating because that moment came from her lying in a pool of blood. She was so stressed she'd fallen over and fallen down the stairs, and she had this sort of epiphany. And she is an extraordinary woman and an extraordinary presenter, and definitely seeing her speak made me think, and in fact her questions to me about my children, and as a businesswoman, the first thing she asked me about was my life, not my job. And you immediately make a connection with her because of that. I mean, from my point of view, I've learnt that exercise is important. It doesn't matter if it's even just a walk. And to never think that 5 a.m. is too early to get up in the morning, if you need to do that. certainly with my children, to not forget that they are the most incredible things that I've ever created or ever will. And so to not let them come second all the time, although in reality there are occasions when they just have to because of your job, but also to come to terms with that, because I think that that is a really big, the guilt factor for full-time working mothers is a really dangerous and very stressful thing that can potentially, I think, even maybe make us sick. So, you know, those things are very, very important to me. And then I have a mother who rings me pretty much daily, who also rings my assistant daily. Tells us everything that we need to do and checks that I've done everything I'm meant to do and make sure that I've eaten all the food I'm meant to make sure that I eat it. And I think if you are lucky enough, and I consider myself very, very lucky to have that wonderful mother in my life, I hope that when my girls are working and, you know, when they're trying to make it all balance, you know, balance it all, that I'll ring them and make them laugh and check up on them in the most ridiculous ways, no matter how successful they ever end up. Yeah, so I guess they're all things that for me.
Thank you. Can we have a microphone down the front here?
Firstly, thank you for an absolutely wonderful discussion. I'd like to raise the issue of women having the courage to take credit for our achievements. Now, if we look at the history of Catherine, her achievements were incredible. But over the last 300 years, everyone else has claimed credit or been given credit for her achievements, from Potemkin to her husbands to her lovers to whoever else took over from her and wrote her out of history. But I do think that it is a common problem that women, whether we're the woman behind the man or whatever the situation is, one of the key things that we need to do is to have the courage to take credit for our achievements. Would you agree with this?
Yes or no?
Well, you know, I listened to that, but I'm thinking also, you know, of a wonderful old saying, it's amazing how much you can achieve when it doesn't matter who gets the credit. I think the word courage is a very important one, and speaking up, that's why I say our voice is the most important tool we have. Some women do stand back. You know, I guess that's what Lean In's all about to a great extent, isn't it?
Helen, would you like to comment on that?
Yeah, I absolutely think we should. But I've been thinking, certainly over the last couple of days, given the, you know, minor hiccup in Australian democracy, that it's wonderful that Australia is now seen as, you know, one of the most unstable democracies in the... but what that's made me think about is the way in which women like Julie Bishop and Petta Credlin have now become the source of why Tony Abbott fell. You know, somehow their fault. I rather think it was his own fault. But it seems to me that if that is going to happen, then women should, of course, be prepared to take credit for the, you know, the fantastic things that they do. Absolutely.
I think that's absolutely true. But I think if you feel you're in an environment where you have to defend yourself all the time, it's very uncomfortable. But I also think there is a difference, and I referred to it earlier, about the stage in your career. when women are younger in their careers, the young women that I mentor, I always encourage them to take credit for their achievements and to be proud of what they've done and to raise their profile. But when you get to an older stage in your career, as I see myself now, I'm only as strong as my team. So I give entire credit to my team, because I wouldn't have achieved any of what we've done as a group without each person in that team. I don't feel the need to say, oh, I did that. I always say the team did that. But it's okay for me to do that now, whereas a younger woman maybe 20 years ago would need someone to help her take credit.
Mm, good point. We have a question here.
We've heard a little bit about keeping calm tonight, and I wanted to hear the panel's thoughts on perceptions of emotionality in the workplace and women, and do we think that there are unique opportunities or challenges for women when managing their own emotions or their teams?
Great question. Yeah. Who wants to tackle that one? Edwina?
We see a lot of emotions, actually. See a lot of emotions. No, I promise it's not me. We work in an open plan office, and sometimes I think, oh no, we've got to go in there and shut the door. I know. We need yoga, I agree. But, you know, with all the compassion in the world, I do think that it is something that you do have to keep in check. You just do. If you want to succeed, that doesn't mean that you have to disappear and go and cry in the bathrooms. And by all means, you can say that you're upset about something. But to break down all the time, and I guess this comes to the point of this too will pass. It is really important to remind young staff that this is really not the end of the world. I mean, my family, it's just frocks, like really. The world is not going to fall apart because the shoe didn't arrive or something, you know. and also, I do think kindness, to remind colleagues. I do find that the competitive nature of, especially when you have a lot of young staff at similar stages in their careers, sometimes they can be the most unkind towards one another. And I tell them a story of I was an assistant with Gillian Davison, who then came back from New York to work with me. But we worked together for about 6 years on Vogue. And I remember she used to drive me mad. I used to think it was all so unfair, and Jill got this and she got this and I got that. And I remember constantly comparing myself to her. And in the long run, when I got the job at Vogue, I asked her to come back from New York. Consequently, Anna Wintour came and poached her back again. But anyway, before Anna did, we worked together and created a dream again together. And our relationship and the strength of our friendship, that was more like a sister to me. And the fact that we understood one another aesthetically in a language that's very hard to communicate, to speak, was our greatest strength. And I tell young girls when they're saying to me, well, it's not fair because she's got this and that, I remind them that story all the time, that this person who you're so upset about now may end up being the biggest strength of your career. You just can't see it yet.
Time is upon us. Time to go out and conquer in whatever way is meaningful to you. This has been the most wonderful hour spent in the company of these amazing women. The Honourable Dame Quentin Bryce, Ruth Picker, a partner at Ernst & Young, Edwina McCann, the Editor-in-Chief of Australian Vogue, and Helen Sullivan, Director of the Melbourne School of Government. Please will you join me in thanking them.
And big thanks to the wonderful Amanda Smith from me, my colleague here at RN, presenter of The Body Sphere, and that Women in Leadership Forum was inspired by Catherine the Great, an innovator, a powerful leader in history herself, and the focus of the National Gallery of Victoria's big exhibition, Masterpieces from the Hermitage, The Legacy of Catherine the Great, which is on until the 8th of November. And so that's the David Bowie and Catherine the Great exhibition I've got to get to in Melbourne this month. No pressure. Well, don't forget, we're also after your little acts of kindness this week as part of ABC's Mental As and Mental Health Week. Please check out the Life Matters website for more info about how to get your stories, your gestures, your examples, vignettes from your life to us. And don't forget to use the hashtags if you're posting them on social media. #ABCLittleActs and #MentalAs, so we can capture them. I'm Natasha Mitchell. I'll catch you tomorrow.